interview with Dr. Jacob Friedland on April 13th, 1978 for the Oral History Project on Endodontics. Now, if you would, Dr. Friedland, would you go into your background a little bit, your education, your interest in dentistry, endodontics in particular?
At what level? University or dental school?
From wherever you want to start. You can start from the beginning. You can start at any point along the way.
I was born and raised in a small eastern Carolina town on the coast. Went to the University of North Carolina. Left there and went to what was at that time Atlanta Southern Dental College. And I was in the class of 1936. While in dental school, I became interested in endodontics in a way, primarily because of the identification of Harry B. Johnston, who at that time was probably the only limited endodontic practitioner in the world, and one of the pioneers of the technique of the Johnston-Callahan technique.
What was that?
Well, from 32 to 36. He was held in esteem by the faculty, and I think that most students look upon those who are held in esteem as an idol or a goal figure that tend to emulate, at least to seek identifications of a nature that they respected. And he was one of several that I felt, as did many of my peers at that time, that he had achieved something in the professional life of dentistry that was meaningful. Had a very strong missionary type of dedication, not only in the profession, but in his total life cycle. Was a part-time teacher, had a practice in town, and it impressed me that people would travel such great distances to seek his services to save a tooth. In substance, education in those days, class 36, preceded the actual survey of dentistry for the documentation of what constituted a approved program.
Okay.
It's strange on reflection that when I was in school, there was really no criteria for what an approved program was in dentistry. It wasn't until 1939 that they set forth a ruling that a dental school had to be under the aegis of the university in order to achieve accreditation. The school that I went to, in some ways, reflected what was going on in the country at that time, a large number of proprietary schools, each of whom felt that they had the best technical trained faculty to turn out the best trained dentist. And the primary goals, at least where I went to school, was to fill a tooth or learn how to remove it, with the departments in the school being very strong in areas of prosthodontics, crown and bridge, and oral surgery. We were one of the very few schools at that time that even taught endodontics as part of the curriculum, because it was not a requisite as far as a pre-doctoral program in dentistry. When I finished dental school, I had some strong... Yeah, it became Emory when they had to have university affiliation. This came about actually in a very peculiar way, because once the criteria set forth in 39 took place, you had the interference of the war in 41, and then this went into the 45 era, so actually it was almost 10 years later before they could literally implement the four-year program under accreditation programs that were initially instituted in the late 30s. When I finished school, I was somewhat less than enthusiastic about dentistry. It just didn't seem to me to carry the broad area of interest for me to justify my spending my life in the profession. I went north at that time, and I had some friends who were involved in dentistry on a broader area than just the southeastern region or where I lived, or Atlanta. I had an opportunity to see some difference in dental education and what dentistry could do. Both not only in New York area, went to Eastman's in Rochester, and also went out to Detroit, Michigan, and saw some of the things that were evolving then with some of the programs. And this motivated me to realize that what I had in essence was a technical education that had a potential limitation that was not necessarily the sum and substance of the practice of dentistry. It was also the impression given that practices tend to evolve with young men from a routine maintenance operative crown and bridge to ultimately a prosthodontic type practice. As people grew older, they lost their teeth. This also had no great attraction for me. The idea of removing teeth or making dentures was not one of my great skills. And the probability is that one of the motivations for me to do something in dentistry didn't necessarily involve extraction or prosthodontics.
Was there anybody or any one particular thing that got you interested in endodontics per se? And what type of training was available?
There was no training available at that time, but I knew of.
Was it the type of thing where you just had to branch into it yourself?
Well, they had preceptor type situations. As I know, actually, even in the 60s, when I was on the national board, American Board of Endodontics, an extremely qualitative group of people, there were nine men. At the time that I came on, there had been two previous members. I think one was Darrell Ostrander. Forgotten who the other one was. It may have been John Pear or Edgar Coolidge. But sitting on a board looking around in 62, 63, with men such as Ralph Sommer from Michigan, Kiesel from Illinois, John Engel from Seattle, George Stewart from Philadelphia, Lou Grossman from Philadelphia, Larry Lucas from Oklahoma City. I can't think of his name from Indiana. Harry Healy from Indiana. I was the only limited practitioner on the board. That everybody on that board either had a dual specialty or was in general practice. And that was surprising when I realized it just by accident one day looking around the room. So, as far as the motivation of endodontics, I think in a way I had an opportunity when I went into general practice. In 1938, I'd been out of school about 2 years, and I spent 2 years in the military service thinking of the military as a career. I didn't stay there because they didn't offer me the stimulus. And I became a little fearful that I stayed in that particular environment at that particular time, that I might not be able to grow, and growth was what I needed primarily. When I went into practice, I had some strong reservations about some practice areas in which I didn't particularly care for. And after practicing several years, I ended up in the military, again because of the war. I was called into service because I was a reserve officer before Pearl Harbor. And in the Army, I was assigned to a general hospital for 2 years. And I was the only one there who was even interested in doing endodontics. And of course, that sort of generated to me. And that excited me, interested me. Then I was sent down to Van Dorn, Mississippi as a dental coordinator for special troops for Third Army. In a way, that situation may have crystallized in my mind some concepts that I'd been rather vague about. We had a 25-chair clinic, and I was the coordinator for the dentist and the various types of units that were assigned for this type of activity. And we had a lot, there was an oral surgery clinic there that was taken over by a member of the local group who was station common assignment, where we were, in essence, transient troops with Army assignments. That meant that we came in for training, then we moved out, and other troops came in with the station common stay there. And there was a chap in oral surgery that was a rather difficult person. And one day I had a kid that was a twin in a unit out of the Ohio area. He had a rather extensive proximal cavity in the central incisor, and I sent him back for an x-ray. There was one x-ray unit in the whole clinic in the military. And it was controlled under the jurisdiction of the chap who was doing oral surgery. Now, we had to make a request for a patient to get an x-ray to that particular section. And as I'm walking through the hallways, I see this young chap with a cotton exodontia sponge clamped down, his mouth closed. And I said, "What happened to you?" He said, "He pulled my tooth out." Well, it incensed me. He didn't have authority to treat Army patients, meaning Third Army patients, other than that which was requested. It was quite a problem. So I took over that section and had him transferred out, and we started within our own type troops doing endodontic therapy and prophylactic type treatments on extensive carious lesions or fillings that had to be reconstituted, rather than using extractions as a means of rendering a service to troops who were getting ready to go overseas. And we did a volume of work there. The problem we had with some of the dentists was to take the time to do a restorative procedure on a tooth that could be done, rather than take the easy way and take the tooth out if there's an extensive carious lesion or an extensive operative requirement. A very difficult solution. I remember one day that an officer who'd been in the Pacific transferred back to this particular camp, and he sent a tooth down, sent a patient down to have a tooth extracted, a molar with an extensively large filling that had fallen out, and he marked it for extraction. I happened to see the case, and I wrote a little note, "I think this tooth can be restored." The patient came back in a few minutes with obviously a number 6 or an 8 round burr, obviously intentionally placed into the pulp chamber, with a note from the dentist upstairs, "Let me see you fix this one." And obviously this gruntled dentist was venting his unhappiness on the patient. Very traumatic situation for me and for him. Of course, I threatened to court-martial him. When he didn't realize that I was technically his superior. And we had quite a round robin on it. But that was really no solution. Authority is never an answer. I got 2 young kids in, one from the New York and the Boston area, who just finished school, and they were assigned to this particular area, and I took them aside and I said, "If you want to learn something about dentistry, just work on the patients that are sent down here for extractions. And if you don't get in the patients all day, you can read and smoke or drink Coca-Cola, I don't care. Just only work on this type of category." I still see these people. I go to a meeting and see them come across a ballroom and say hello to me. They did learn a lot. I learned something too. There are people who are interested in doing this type of dentistry and there are people who are not. And it gave me a sense of maybe well-being. This was an area that had, for me, a level of satisfaction I hadn't really found in a defensive sense earlier. So even overseas and even in the field, under a tree out in the open area with a foot-type engine, and with no radiology to support it, just by what we had learned as a digital skill mechanism, we were doing endodontic procedures without any of the sophisticated accoutrements that we have in an office. And I felt right good about it. I felt in a way that it was a measure for me as a dentist to do something that was, I thought, constructive rather than destructive. Came back home, I made an effort to improve my knowledge and competence. Went to Atlanta, spent some time with Harry Johnson in his office. He's a very outstanding, skillful person, very benevolent. I mentioned earlier about his missionary concept. He was more than willing to share. I don't want to get into personality references necessarily. He had no compunction about sitting on a train for 2-3 days and going to California and sharing his knowledge with people there and coming back and feeling rewarded, not because the honorarium was there, but just because of his own sense of dedication. I think that he, among many, many others, are in essence the substance why we have achieved what we have. More than the fact that we've evolved necessarily some of the scientific data or some of the sophisticated skills that we say we have today.
What year was that you were talking about?
I didn't go. I was not with him. I visited with him, spent some time with him in his office. This was in 46, 47.
What was Endodontics like in that time? What were other people doing? How did
it wasn't
folk infection, things like that affect?
Folk infection had a very strong impact in the Southeast, as it had in many other areas. We lived, in essence, in those days, even the military days, under an oral surgery prosthodontic philosophy. Most of the educators who were in positions of authority, most of the professional leaders in the country, pretty well represented that particular philosophy and attitude of dental practice. And it was pretty well accepted, not only by the profession, but also by the public at large. It was an anticipated evolution in an aging process. And in the reference of this particular situation, one of the real strong centers was Mayo's. I had a patient who had Berger's disease, had a maxillary molar that was root canal. There was no radiographic evidence of any pathosis. He went to Mayo's for some medical care because of the circulatory impairment that he had with Berger's disease. They wouldn't consider. They had to remove all pulpless teeth, whether there was any evidence of pathosis or symptom or function, just as a cardinal rule that these were injurious to the basic health of the patient. Uniquely, in a sense, I became one of the cadre that oriented the Mayo unit into the Army. So the human equation got balanced in that transition. Very interesting.
What is the Mayo organization? Is that the Mayo Clinic?
Mm-hmm. Watch the Minnesota. Then I took some time after that, tried to become knowledgeable. There weren't too many places to go. Spent some time at Penn with Grossman, who an amazing personality in those days. Had a small group, and we spent two solid weeks there. Intense. He would start at 8 o'clock in the morning. He had the ingenious capacity to be as enthusiastic at 4:30 in the evening lecturing as it was at 8 o'clock in the morning. It impressed me too that if he got a message of some urgency and he had to go answer the telephone, he wouldn't excuse himself to go answer the phone. He would literally apologize for leaving and run from the lecture room to the telephone. You could hear him run back to the room so that he wouldn't miss a moment of sharing in his teaching. And his teaching, in essence, almost totally by himself. He had some assistance as far as the clinical reference was concerned. He had both the didactic and the clinical program there in his 2 weeks program. Then I went to Michigan, spent several weeks there with the Samo Strander Crowley group, and both programs to me were exciting and interesting, and they were different. They were not necessarily repetitive. The Michigan approach was different. They had a more silver cone type orientation. You had a broader range of disciplines brought in to evaluate in the Michigan program in that particular time than we had in the Penn program.
What years were these approximately?
Early 50s, late 40s, early 50s.
When was the first actual program instituted?
It was a one-year program, to my knowledge, at Michigan. To my knowledge, that was the first postdoctoral program. In fact, ironically, Herbie Johnson's son studied dentistry and went to Michigan to take the one-year program in endodontics. And the protocol of his research was to prove the rationale of his father's technique, which was ionization, thorough biomechanical instrumentation and cleansing. Harry Johnson did not do cultures as such. And he used the diffusion technique, the utilization of grain alcohol to dehydrate a canal, then to place in the canal a volume of chlororosin, which was a use of rosin, which is a very sticky agent, dissolved in the chloroform, which he would flood the canal, mix no paste as such. Then he would agitate the gutta percha cone into the canal in order to completely obliterate the canal with the gutta percha substance. Intentionally tried to develop a button, which he used to rationalize as being a reserve for the shrinkage that would take place because of the high volume chloroform gutta percha percentages that he used, that they would take from the button the extra gutta percha in order to compensate for the gutta percha that shrank. He ionized in those days for 30 minutes at, I think, roughly 0.5 to 1 milliamp with Churchill's iodine as a sterilizing media. It was his concept that it sterilized a tooth in an area beyond the root equal to the dimensional size of one dime. That was the area that he described. Incidentally, I still have those notes in my attic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do. I do indeed.
You can remember and send a copy.
Well, why don't you make a note of that? Because I don't plan to remember everything I'm asked to do at this meeting, because it's not only impossible, but it's even inhuman to expect it.
Yes.
Why don't you write?
I will.
They gave for his son the protocol to prove his dad's theory, and they use in Michigan a rather unique approach for sterilization. One of the personnel in the department was Mary Crowley, who was the microbiologist at the School of Dentistry at the University of Michigan. And they had formulated the concept that in order to get a predictable sample for sterilization, that you had to get two samples of a canal. If you had a single canal and two separate gutta percha cones, paper points, into one culture media. And if you had a molar, then you ended up with six. If you had three canals, you ended up with six paper points for that particular sample. And they didn't feel in their teaching that a root canal filling should be filled, that a root canal should be filled until you had two successive negative cultures. They use as their primary intracanal agent camphor pimolachlorophenol. And they did at that time use a double seal after they placed the intracanal agent in. And when Harry Johnson used ionization in comparison to the with the double culture concept, it took over seven visits for a patient to achieve the double negative culture, in contrast to 4.1 or 2 visits using camphor pimolachlorophenol. So actually, the son disproved his father's theory. And the son went into medicine and practiced surgery in a small town in Georgia, no longer practicing. Whether this was the trigger that moved him from dentistry to medicine, I don't know. But obviously, this didn't necessarily motivate him to stay in a particular field that his daddy had achieved recognition. Became impressed with the Michigan program, as well as I did the Penn program, and found that these two schools had been the fountainhead of endodontics historically. In some ways, from historical reference, other than the work done by Ricketts and the Ricketts paste and the open tube concept, was some of the earlier works done at Penn. There was a chap at Penn who was a professor named H.E.A.D. Head, who in 1917 published a book, I think by Lee and Febiger, and it was titled Modern Dentistry. Has 37 pages devoted to endodontics, or root canal therapy, and the basic principles of endodontics is damn well established in that book published in 1917. I have a copy of that too at home. Some of the sophisticated gadgetry we use today certainly wasn't available. But in essence, there's very little there that we see today that's new. I also have a film that was done by M.L. Ryan. M.L. Ryan was, in essence, one of the disciples and missionaries for Harry B. Johnson's Johnson-Callahan technique in the eastern area, New York area. Coincidentally, he was in practice with Dr. Van Bailey, who was the father of E.C. Van Bailey, who was president of the AAE in 1969, maybe. But the senior Van Bailey and M.L. Ryan worked together, and at that time, M.L. Ryan did a movie with 24-millimeter film and little small snatches showing the technique and concept of doing endodontics, and I have that film. We took the film to the National Medical Audiovisual Center and had them transpose the 24-millimeter sections that we had into a 16-millimeter, 18-20-minute film, 16-millimeter film, runs about 18-20 minutes, And it shows the instrumentation, the rubber dam application, the use of gutta percha. And he too used the extrusion of gutta percha apically as part of Johnson Callahan concept. And Ron was the first person, apparently, who used a gold wire to measure root length radiographically. In 1913, 1917, I have that film.
Is that the earliest film that you know of as far as endodontics?
It's the only one that I know of that vintage. You know, photography was, motion picture photography in that day was relatively limited. They used bichloromercury, they used some other agents that we don't use today because of its biological imposition on viable tissue. But as far as the instrumentation, the mechanics, and the skills, and the concept, there isn't a lot different. They filled, for instance, a molar in three separate visits. Not three separate visits from the standpoint of what we call opening, cleansing, culturing, and then filling. They filled each root separately. They didn't fill three roots at one time. Obviously, there must have been some postoperative difficulty, and there might have been wisdom in that day in controlling the postoperative pain to only take one root at a time as far as the obliteration of the canal, obturation of the canal is concerned. What motivated me in endodontics? I'd say maybe a sense of satisfaction in my own context. I'd say this to a great extent is self-serving. And I think in a professional field, the self-serving syndrome is not necessarily a liability. That with all of the attributions that you get in the professional world, I think being able to work in an area gives you some sense of satisfaction within the scope of your own skills and talents has much merit. I enjoy it. I think it's a significant point of reference and a very satisfying one.
Into a little bit about the history of endodontics as a specialty, the start of the AAE recognition.
I was not a charter member of the AAE. The AAE started during the war, and they've never made a provision for some of the earlier people who were in the military to be identified as charter members. I was in the service 4.5 years. I wasn't discharged until February of 46. I believe if you got an AAE piece of paper here, the AAE's the seal should carry the on the incorporation seal used to carry the beginning. But I don't believe I was here at the time that the AAE started. Now take a look at the past presidents. See what year it started, might give you some indication here. I believe the past president listed somewhere. They usually list them. Out of curiosity, how many was during the middle of the war. Now, Clive Davis also wrote a book. And in his book on operative dentistry is a large section of endodontics. And I have that book. He was, I think, at that time dean in Iowa. Now, I remember once in one of the surveys that was done, they asked him about endodontics. They did, students did one or two or three cases last year, and he hopes they'll do more in the future, something to that particular reference. I think I've got that reference, too. So here you see in 43, most of the people had already been called into service, and most of them didn't get back until late 45, because the war with Japan wasn't over with until August of 45. Before most of them got home, it took some months. Unless they'd been wounded or brought back for other reasons.
What were the problems that endodontics encountered within the profession and also within the endodontic grouping per se, people who were doing endodontics?
Not that many people doing endodontics. There were some men who were doing it as a matter of philosophy. I know that in Atlanta one time, one of the oral surgeons, or rather eminent oral surgeon, if you speak of eminence in a relative sense in that area, made a comment on the podium that he built the driveway at his house with the income he derived from extracting the teeth that Harry P. Johnson had saved. It was a rather ugly remark in its connotation. It may have been said with a perverted sense of humor. I thought it was an offensive statement. Of course, it denigrated a man who, in every sense, was dedicated. There was some controversy, and this part of the transition from what you might call dentistry in those days, from the oral surgery prosthodontic concept to the conservation or conservative dentistry. But that statement was accepted by the vast majority as a statement of humor and a statement of fact, and there was no one who really raised an issue. Maybe I'm a little more sensitive to things of that nature than other people, but it bothered me. Johnson was not himself a dynamic personality. He didn't have the rhetoric or the aggressiveness maybe to be as I don't really know what the adjective to use to present his material. He was sort of a soft sell fellow, perfectly willing, had smiling benevolence about him. He tithed. When I say he was religious, he had religious posters up in his reception room. He wasn't so religious that he had credits. He was on a cash basis. His patients paid him when he finished. He didn't send out any bills. Now, I know what this had to do with religiosity. Maybe it comes from that passage in the Bible that says, neither a borrower nor a lender be. I never asked him, so I don't know. But he had a cash practice. People came, people paid, and people came to see him from great distances. That impressed me, that a patient had a damn sight more respect for his dentition than the dentist had. And that seemed to me somewhat of a dichotomy. It bothered me a little bit. Then I realized that...